Accession number 31394, Reel 2.
Jack Hoskins, Reel 2.
Yeah.
Jack, can I just take you back with those Atlantic patrols? At that stage, when you joined 221 Squadron, did you have a tour? Were you given a length of tour at that stage?
No, there wasn't. They didn't have a length of tour at that time, as far as I can remember. But then they did change it to 30 trips, and that became the standard tour.
And you would, when you were operating over the Atlantic, was there a specific area that you would go to in the Atlantic?
No, just where one was sent, really, due west from Ireland, I mean, or could be northwest, or just south of Iceland, and the same, well, out as far as one could go, in sort of 5 hours out, so about 500 miles out and 500 miles back.
And what were you armed with?
Initially, I think we only had bombs, but afterwards they had Torpex, I think it was Torpex bombs, which were anti-submarine bombs, specially designed for it.
How did they differ from normal bombs?
I really couldn't know the technical details, but they were certainly, they tended to explode, I think, with greater force.
During that period as well in the Atlantic, would you ever do convoy escort duties?
Yeah, yes, there were occasionally one went out to meet a convoy coming in, or would fly alongside a convoy going out to America, obviously. And sometimes they'd go well out into the Atlantic and they'd turn south then to go down to the Mediterranean.
And your Wellingtons, what kind of camouflage did they have? What colour were they?
In fact, initially, if I remember, I think we were just a standard Bomber Command, sort of blackish colour. And then eventually, they all got painted white. I think, did they have a light blue underneath, something like that? But they thought white would show up less than black in the sky. And in fact, in the thing I've given you there, there is a photograph of what I'm in white.
And you never encountered any U-boats during that period?
No. And later on, when we're in the Mediterranean, I attacked a U-boat at night. But it was very difficult because, I mean, one had to get down to 50 or 60 feet to drop the bombs. And, you know, getting down there on at night time with nothing, see, you were a bit wary. And what the result was, I don't think we damaged it at all. They were quite difficult targets.
So how long were you in the operating in the Atlantic?
In the Atlantic, not very long, really, because I was tour expired soon after, perhaps after 3 months, and I was sent to RAF Silloth up in on the borders nearly as an instructor for the Wellington School for Coastal Command.
What would you like to do with to instruct up there?
With no training as an instructor, I mean, it was a bit odd. one coped, and in fact, the Silloth, what's that? Solway Firth that comes in at Silloth, used to be known as Hudson's Bay because there were a lot of Hudsons also training there, and a good many of them went into Solway Firth, so they renamed it Hudson Bay.
So given you didn't have any training as an instructor, how did you instruct your pupils?
One really didn't even have dual control in the aircraft. One just was standing alongside at that time, but they did afterwards get dual control.
And what level were they at that stage?
I don't know how much flying they'd done. No idea.
Had they converted to the Wellington already, had they?
No, they hadn't converted even to it. They'd come off probably Anson's again, as I did.
So your role...
But most of them were going, they were going to do a tour as a second pilot for a while. They got their experiences that. And then if they were good enough, they were made captains.
So your role, am I right in thinking that your role will be then to familiarise them with the Wellington?
But really familiarise, yes.
How it works.
Yes. What? And then we were... The Hudsons really didn't particularly like us being there. they were busy, and so we were sent to RAF Cranwell, and so we departed to Cranwell.
was that different?
It was different, because then instead of being mixed up with a lot of Hudsons, one was mixed up with a lot of flying training aircraft, the light ones, and they didn't like being having big legs, to, big Wellingtons going off alongside them. And but it had a very long runway, of course, at Cranwell, which they built for the long-range flight they did out to New Zealand or somewhere at that time. So there was, at least there was a very long runway one could take off from. But they were always afraid of the college being bombed, because there was activity at night. They wouldn't allow us to fly at night there at one time. So we had to go over to a place called Skellingthorpe, which was being developed as a Bomber Command airfield, but Bomber hadn't taken it over yet. So we went there and did our night flying from there. And it was there one night, actually, I was taking off with a pupil and got about 50 feet and one engine packed up. Well, the old Welling at that time was useless on one engine pretty well. How we got around that circuit, I do not know. I don't think we got higher than 50 feet on a dark night. The nights were dark in England when there was no all blackout everywhere. And all there was a electric flare path, which had just electric bulbs every 20 yards, something like this. And so we just tried to keep your eye on that. And we struggled around, making a noise, and landed safely, as a matter of fact, but frightened.
So the Wellington would perform on one engine, but it wasn't...
It would, but not well. And it wouldn't climb.
After this period of instructing, what was the next stage for you?
I then, in the end of 42, that's right, I was sent on rest. Most people, in fact, came back to England, because there was only one Wellington squadron, so doing the work in the Middle East, there wasn't a requirement for them to go elsewhere, and so they were shipped back to England. My turn came at the end of 42, and my father had just had a slight heart attack, and I lost a brother in the North African landings. He was in the regular Navy, and they were torpedoed at night, and the whole crew were lost virtually, except the ones that happened to be on deck. And I lost a brother, and I thought, oh, good, compassionate grounds for getting back. But they wouldn't allow me to go. Everybody else had gone. No, I was sent up to right up at Benghazi. And it was a really old hole then. What a place for a rest.
Can I take you back to joining the squad? Hearing about when you were going to go to the Middle East in the first place. Where were you at the time?
When we were sent to the Middle East, I was at Cranwell.
Yeah.
And then I'd had enough of instructing. And I knew a chap on the 2-1 squadron, who was a civilian flying instructor, and he was keen to do instructing, so I managed to swap with him, and the Air Minister accepted it.
And where did you return to the squadron?
And I returned to the squadron. The squadron had then come back from Iceland, where they went from Nimavady to Iceland, and they came back from Iceland, and they were reforming at RAF Bertram Newton, and getting new aircraft and things.
Was that in preparations to go to the Middle East?
That was preparation to go to the Middle East, yes.
How did you get to the Middle East?
Flew there via Gibraltar. It was about an 8-hour flight to Gibraltar. We had to fly down to Cornwall, and then early morning one took off from Cornwall to go to Gibraltar, and one went out fair way into the Atlantic, because the whole of the French coast there was patrolled by Germany. And then one came into Gibraltar, which for our aircraft was a very short runway. It was just a little bit over the neck of land, over the isthmus there. And the next morning, it was all one could do was to get the aircraft off the ground in time before it ran into the sea.
Were you carrying squadron personnel? And
yes, we had three ground crew with us as well, and loaded up the hilt with stuff and baggage and flying servicing equipment, all that, and a bomb ray. And so the aircraft was pretty heavy. And the next morning, getting off on an 800-yard runway, it was touch and go, because you want to get to Malta, which is an 11-hour flight for us. You had to be absolutely full of fuel, and away we went.
What were the dangers of flying across the Mediterranean at that time, the potential threats?
At that time, it wasn't bad, no. The dangers, A, would be the weather, if anything else. And then when you got through the Sicilian Narrows, of course, the Germans had occupied Sicily, that you had to get through there in the dark. And so, and then we got to Malta, or just approaching Malta, and we got air raid warning from Malta. And then you had to wait, circle south of Malta until the air raid was over. And so eventually one was called in, one landed at Malta.
Where were you based at Malta?
RF Lucca. And I was only there the one night, but the day in between was, one was supposed to be sleeping, but it was a bit rough because the bombing was very intense at that time. And then we took off the next evening, and I had a lady and two daughters as passengers, because they were bringing the RAF families out from Malta because it was so rough for them. And I had, let's say, the lady who was the wife of an armaments officer and his two daughters in the aircraft. And so they had to put up with this, what seat they could find in the back of the aircraft for an 8-hour trip to Cairo.
And where did you land when you got to Cairo?
We landed just, it wasn't far off the pyramids, really, a desert landing ground there. And there they accepted, and we just stayed overnight there. And the next day we flew up to what was called a landing ground at number 89 in the western desert and joined the rest of the squadron there.
And what was going to be your role, the squadron role?
Anti-submarine and anti-shipping, of course. And perhaps particularly worried about the Italian fleet, of course, they were coming out and doing searches for that, if there's any suspicion of it being out.
So what were you armed with?
At that time, it'd be just 500-pound bombs, I remember. I can't... yes, 500-pound bomb, but eventually went on to torpedoes.
What were living conditions like for you in the desert?
The flies were the biggest worry. Flies everywhere. You put food in your mouth and you had to sort of shake, stop my mouth and pop your food in your mouth quickly and things like that. The heat was made one sweat, but it was a dry heat. It wasn't too bad at all. Singapore was far worse because it's humid as well, but the desert wasn't too bad in that. And sickness wasn't a great problem as far as I recall. Jippy tummy was, because that was food then causing that.
And what were you living in?
Tents. But then, fortunately, say we could go back to the canal zone, and there were three or four airfields there built before the war as permanent base with hangars and all living accommodation, everything. I mean, one was just comfortable there. And, of course, there was no rationing of food or anything down there. And one lived like lords, as the saying goes.
So can you take me through sort of a typical early operation that you did from there, where you would, what area you would patrol, what you would be looking for?
Well, we patrol from, we used to go to the advanced landing ground, LD 89, which, as I say, was Sidi Barani, and one would go westward almost as far as Malta and back, and go up towards the Tour of Italy on the north-westerly, and then around to Crete and all that, just looking for shipping. And
And were they then targets of opportunity? For
they are opportunity targets, yes.
Can you tell me about any of the targets that you encountered?
I was lucky in that I did nearly all flare work, in, you know, carrying a lot of flares so to illuminate targets. So I didn't actually, as far as I recall, bomb any then.
So would you... What would happen then? Would you be working in pairs or...?
Yeah, one would be working in pairs or even more. And you'd have a flared dropper and two or three attack aircraft. One called them in and one used to send out a continuous radio signal so they could home in on you on the sets. And funnily enough, one day we got a signal from the Navy saying, thank you very much for your signals that led us to the target. And one of the British submarines had picked up the signal, and the ship that we were leading the aircraft in, he torpedoed.
So what type of ships were you seeing there? Were they mainly warships or were they merchant ships?
No, they were merchant ships trying to get into, well, Tripoli or Benghazi, out supplying the German army.
And were these night operations?
Night, all night. Pretty well all night. It might get run into a bit of daylight.
So how would you spot the aircraft? How would you spot the ship?
With radar. We had very good radar, really, at that time. But then just the Germans cottoned onto it, of course, as they always did, and they had started jamming the radar, and that made it more difficult. You're trying to read through the jamming.
So when the wireless operator picks somebody up, picks up a ship on the, on the radar, would then he would tell you which direction to hit him with it?
It was a circular screen they had, so they could tell what direction from the ship it was, and they could lead you onto it.
And then would you have to pick it up visually?
Visually in the end, yes.
Seems so simple.
What were the other operations? Was that the only operations you were involved in with the flare dropping, or were you actually involved in?
No, they were the only ones, because we weren't bomber. They had bombers to cope with the bombing of Benghazi and all that as a separate group. No, we only did the. We were all anti-shipping all the time.
What were casualties like in the squadron?
At that time, not heavy. Not heavy at all.
Did the operations change?
It changed. Eventually, at the end of, say, 42, the squadron was shipped to Malta. But I had tour expired, so that's when I went up to Benghazi. But then after I spent 6 months at Benghazi, or south of Benghazi it was... quite enough. I'd had enough of it up there in the wilderness.
What were you doing at Benghazi?
On the operations. In the operations room.
And what did that actually entail, Joe?
Briefing aircraft. Aircraft used to come up there and we'd brief them. They used to do wreckers up to Greece and, well, again out towards Malta and all that. And so just briefing them that we got reports of. And there was a little chap who used to appear in civilian clothes. I couldn't make out of a little chap who used to go and have words with the station commander. Well, I never knew really what he did. But now, of course, I know he was part of the Y service. And they were listening in and saying there's a transport was building up in Italy, you know, and was obviously going to run the gauntlet. And one got full information on this. One used to wonder why you'd sit there now for a week and nothing happened, and suddenly all hell let loose.
At that time you were promoted too?
No, later.
What was the ops room like?
The ops room? In a tent. It wasn't very grand at all. One had the minimum of facilities.
What happened after the 6 months in Benghazi?
In Benghazi, well, I got fed up, and I knew the chap on the squadron again who would willingly exchange, so I managed to arrange an exchange visit back to the squadron again, but this time on Malta, of course. And I arrived there in, I think it was March 43. Yeah.
What were they doing at that time?
They, again, anti-shipping on the, up to the Italian coast, and also keeping a watch on the Italian fleet if necessary.
Had they had most of their casualties by this stage?
Malta by this stage was getting calmer, yes. There wasn't the bombing and that. And, of course, then the Sicilian landing started, of course, in July. Just that time, and of course all the activity was taking place over Sicily.
Oh. So where were you flying operations to?
At that time, again, all up around Sicily. We used to go right the way around Sicily and have a look at Stromboli, the volcano there. In fact, one could see both Etna and Stromboli going, and we used to go right up to Naples looking for shipping. But there wasn't too much of it. I never dropped a torpedo. There was never the reason to drop one. But I should mention that I was still a sergeant pilot, or flight. I think I did actually achieve flight sergeant pilot, though I never knew it, when we went out to the Middle East there. And but just before we went out to the Middle East, I was commissioned. And so I went out as a pilot officer. And the squadron, when it went there, of course, the people, a lot of them had been on the squadron a long time. And it wasn't long before they started to become tour expired. And they found themselves with very few experienced people. They all went home. And I had to wait until I'd done 6 months as a pilot officer. You couldn't have an acting rank as a pilot officer. And when 6 months was up, I was immediately a flight lieutenant, which normally took 2 years. And then within 3 months again, I was a squadron leader, because no one else had experience there. So I became a squadron leader in mid-42, looking after one of the flights. And so then I was a squadron leader at the end of the year, when I went up on rest to Benghazi. Then went over to Malta, and in March 43, and then at the end of the year, the wing commander had finished his time, and he went home, and I was squadron commander as a wing commander. So I had rather, and this the old thing, getting a promotion this side of the ocean was rather the reverse.
So how did you change your role as you got promoted to wing commander?
One did a torpedo course in Egypt, out of Shalufa, and so that qualified me to go back onto the squadron mode, then on torpedoes. But fortunately, the heavy torpedo work had finished by that time.
Can you tell me about what the procedure is for dropping a torpedo? How you do this?
Dropping a torpedo at night was quite tricky, because you had to drop from about, depending on the speed of the aircraft. But as our aircraft were pretty slow, you had to be very low. Because if you can imagine the torpedo dropping, it gradually noses down and into the water. Well, if you're too high, the thing would nosedive straight in. And so you had to be at roughly 50 feet off the water. Well, 50 feet off of the water at night is a bit hairy.
How did you manage to get
on a moonlight night, the attack would be in the moon path. You'd hope to get the target in the moon path, and then, of course, you could see the sea. But if it wasn't, of course, I knew when there's got to be a moon. If it wasn't, you had aircraft which only had illumination. What do they call them?
Spotlight?
Something bomb. So anyway, they just used to have a very high-powered light, and you'd have aircraft, and they'd drop a string of about five of these, and that would make like a moon path, and so that was the equivalent.
And actually dropping, how would you approach a target? What was the method of approach?
The official approach was 60 degrees on the bow. So you were coming in at 60, and say, as we were relatively slow, you had to get 100 feet or so to drop safe to avoid the torpedo nosediving in. So the losses were tremendous when they were doing a lot of active work, but fortunately for me, it was just before I took over.
And you took over as wing commander, did you? Commanding the when you were wing commander, were you commanding the squadron?
I was commanding the squadron, yes. And I had hardly taken the squadron over, and we were posted from Malta to Italy. Which meant quite a change, because in Italy we were going to be a completely mobile squadron under canvas. There was no permanent airfield we could take to. And I did a reconnaissance up to an airfield called Quintagli, just outside Taranto, where the Italian fleet was based. Of course, by this time it had surrendered. And did this, and I had a look at the airfield, yes, that was okay for us. Then they asked us if we could do a night sortie. So I said yes, so we did a night sortie up the Adriatic and came back. We didn't see anything to bomb, so we came back, brought them back, and we got heading towards the Grattaglia over Italy. And as you'll see in there, we were attacked by a British night fighter. And with our radar, we could pick up the night fighter like that, so we knew he was around. In fact, the chap warned me, we got an aircraft approaching from the rear, and we thought, oh, he's just, identifying us, thing like that. And he came in right close and opened up everything he got. And fortunately for us, that he got in too close, in that he had cannons and machine guns, but the trajectory of a cannon is fairly level, where a machine gun tends to arc up and over, because they're sighted on 500 yards or something like this. So and we were in that clear area to a certain extent between the two, so all we got is cannon shells, and that was quite enough. And we've got cannon shells through propellers on both sides. Took one of the Aeron rods off. It severed the pitot head tube, so we had no air-propelled flying instruments. So we had no artificial horizon, anything like this. And on a darkish night, it's not too good. And of course, what a noise the propellers made with all these hot cannon shells through them.
So what did you do? Did you
say anyway? We had carried on heading back to our base at Quintagli, and made a circuit, went in and landed. I didn't know at the time, of course, but the tires on one side would have been burst. The cannon shell had gone through there. And of course, when you get a tire on one side burst, we eventually, when the speed of landing, touching down, had dropped a bit, one ground loop, one couldn't control it. But it didn't do any further damage. And then, of course, five terrified people got out of the aircraft and looked at the damage and thought, God, how lucky.
The operations that you were running from Italy, what was your kind of area of patrol?
Right up to Trieste, right up to the north of the Adriatic. And one look at the Pola, Trieste and all that, and also all the little seaports down on the Adriatic coast there, because they used to bring in barges mainly in the channel there on the coast, and we would bomb those.
And as a wing commander, would you take part in the kind of routine of operations?
Well, it depends. You didn't have to do as much as the others, but I did. I made sure of that, because I'd served under two COs who didn't fly, and they were both one of them was an Australian who eventually became chief of the Australian Air Force. And I could have told the Australian Air Force that was, and he did, actually became chief of the Australian Air Force. And I don't think he did, if he did an operational trip, he did it as a co-pilot. And I know he could fly well in Zoom because I converted him at Cranwell.
So, does that not go down well in a squadron when the CO doesn't fly?
I should say it doesn't, no. It encourages the rest of to all take the same risk. And saying there was another squadron commander, which he only stayed with us 2 months, and he never flew.